Philosophy 57, January 19th.
The pier came out in 1852, and it remained unread. And it was reprinted in 1929, as you have heard, for the first time. That is to say, this man lay buried for 80 years. He lived physically 40 years of this life of non-existence. And you have to, I hope you will carry away from the last meeting and this the fact that men like Melville or Whitman can at times be condemned not to exist, which is real hell. You have heard that Walt Whitman did not live for the first 36 years. Now with Melville, the strange thing is that he did not live, was not allowed to breathe, so to speak, publicly, but just physically. His son takes his life and he is 18, so the father cannot impart his spirit to him in the midst of the 60s. From 1852 to his death, he is dead. This is very serious, and we haven't even yet found an expression to this. His biographers are very silly about it. There's a book on Melville which is called Tragedy of Mind, which is ridiculous. It's a tragedy of the human soul. His mind was in perfect shape, a very great mind. But in this country, you see, the whole academic world has a conspiracy, which is much worse than the communist conspiracy, always to confound and confuse you by saying mind and soul are the same. You can study in Nietzsche, in Hölderlin in Germany, and in Melville, and even in Whitman in this country, that soul is something utterly different from mind. The soul of Melville was saved by writing Pierre, but he had no body to embody this, and his mind became very weak. He compromised. After that, he went to the Holy Land and wrote a terrible, boring, stupid poem because his father-in-law paid the voyage, and it was a kind of sanitarium, kind of spa undertaking. They wanted to rescue the poor man, you see, from his complete despair and despondency. And the soul was in hell. And to call Tragedy of Mind this book by Sedgwick is a typical academic misunderstanding of our situation in reality, you see. When a man is feeble-minded, when a man has a tumor in his brain, he loses his mind, you see. But this man was roasted and tormented by was the that his soul was sick. Soul sickness is not the same as mind sickness. Tragedy is always a question of the soul, never a question of the mind. It's not tragic when a man goes insane. That's a physical ailment, I mean. That's something very different, something secular, I would say. But the soul, that's your fate. That is your place made out for you in history. Now, at this point, I only want to point to this complete misunderstanding of modern literary criticism, which makes Melville into a tragedy of mind, when for us it is a problem of the soul to live through various generations and to represent other generations to the present generation. This Melville has done like nobody else, because he brings, as I have shown already in the dates of his publication, to us today, you see, something that has been lived in 1852 and never meant anything to the people there. He hasn't existed after Moby Dick in any way, and he died, as you have heard last time, a forgotten man. Nobody knew who he was when the papers mentioned that he died in the, was it 90 or 91?
91.
I think that's very important, the central issue that we have to do with the soul in Melville. Now some other factual things. Benjamin Franklin and Rousseau and Thoreau and all these good people in Concord, Massachusetts, as you know, have worshipped nature. The great step which makes Melville important seems to me in this respect is that as far as the time 1750 to 1950 is concerned as a typical secular line of American life, from Franklin, you see, and the lightning rod via Katahdin to Mr. Washburn and our Arctic Institute, this taking on nature. Melville goes to the end of nature, to the South Sea, and says, let's look at the real nature. And thereby, always when a dream is practically realized, it comes to its end. In Melville, then again, your generation, you see, which may still play with this fantasia of a good nature, that nature is good and just man is bad, or some such thing, is that nature has an ethical character of divinity or something, is already overhauled and is already corrected, because he did anything you might dream when you go in summertime out to Alaska or to Hawaii and try to not to hunt the white whale but to find the innocence of nature. And in this sense, I feel that Melville again has rendered us a tremendous service by doing 100 years ago, you see, in his South Pacific exploits, you see, something that we couldn't even do today because Bikini is already evacuated and is used for atomic bombs. There is no native anymore, native paradise, no earthly Eden. So he has lived it in good time and has left us this desperate attempt to find that which Rousseau proclaims was there before kings and popes and priests and cities and clergy and tyrannies existed. And I feel, would you make this point, any line of vision or dreams, any utopia, comes to an end when the utopia is constructed. Socialist utopia, Thomas More, comes to an end when Mr. Lenin and Stalin do it. And now we can see what the communist plan does mean, you see. And so in the same sense, Melville's realization of the primitive nature in his going to the South Sea is a tremendous medicine, I should think, to put the vision, you see, in the place where it has to be either done or dismissed. You can no longer afford to, the former generation still did before the Second World War, as you know, Thoreau was very much en vogue. Who has read Katahdin by Thoreau? No one? It's all over? That was a favorite, you see. Sidney Cox stood here for this. Who has still met Mr. Cox? You see, he was the last of the Mohicans, really. And he believed in individual salvation by meeting nature. We still have one man on this campus who suddenly can stop on this campus and you ask him what he's doing. I commune with nature. And then he has intercourse with divine nature. He's a remarkable man, but I think he's absolutely crazy. However, I leave this to you, gentlemen, since you are young, it is still your temptation as Americans to think that nature in itself is good. I was brought up with this romantic notion. I have come to know that God did not make nature good and us bad. You see, this is good and evil are not to be found in nature. The evil as little as the good. And it is both wrong to proclaim that nature is evil or that nature is good. It is just has nothing to do with these qualifications which only belong to you and me. This is, I think, of great importance. So would you kindly date this? 1750 is a dream of a holy nature, of the Amazonian Toro Franklin dream, that nature is good and we are only stupid because we do not appreciate the goodness of nature, you see. Is in Melville brought to its conclusion. And the greatness is, however, that it takes 100 years before we, you and I, put Melville in this place. Nobody in 1850, you see, accepted this message. So that although it's uttered accidentally, printed in 1850, the great sermon of the Franklinites in 1750. Secular nature, salvation, you see. Just Voltaire said this, the encyclopedists did it. Mr. Wilson has written this book on Diderot, you see, who held to this belief. In 1750, the dream. In Melville's own existence, the realization how far it can be executed, so to speak. And in our time, the imperative. You have to say goodbye to the Enlightenment. Gentlemen, or America cannot survive, or the whole Western world cannot survive. This is a big order, and you as individuals will not even know how big the order is. But it means that the purely secular, in the sense that the secular can find its frame of reference, its principles of explanation, its way of interpreting life by watching the spider or by watching the bee or the anthill, you see, leads to terrible things. And you know how all anthropologists still are in this temptation. They look at the bee and they look at the ant and then they say we must be a beehive or an anthill. You see, can we? I mean, this or Poor Relations by Mr. Hooton, you know, the book on the apes. People are still in all special fields of human interpretation today completely hipped on this nature business. Nothing is explained for you and me when we know that this occurs somewhere in nature. Because in nature it is neither good nor evil. But we must know whether we should do it. Now, in order to know what we should do, you see, we are not helped by any observation in the state of the animal kingdom, for example. This has tremendous consequences. I would say, gentlemen, this was then here the universal dream. Here it was the practical attempt, of which, by the way, the emancipation of the slaves is an outcome. You have to do it now. If all men are born equal, for heaven's sake, we must even have a civil war. You see, nature must be respected. Now we know, as you well know, that the assimilation of two races is a very painful process and cannot simply be based on an abstract proclamation. It has to be done in time and in due time and with many restrictions. And this is here, I think you are provoked to dismiss the frame of reference given by the term nature. Because you cannot say that by nature you are anything. We are nothing by nature. Man is that which being which has in every moment to get a new nature, obviously. Every generation has to get a new nature. So, if I may put here this figure 1950, you see how Melville is in eclipse for energy, that his voice carries into our ears with much more meaning than it did in his own day. Which is in itself, gentlemen, a tremendous problem of the generations ago. If you put here the figure 1890, and if you will recall that I said this man lives one generation, his soul can embody, and another generation his soul has to live disembodied. And you see that another 40 years it takes before he is heard. And now we can embody his problem, so to speak, in actuality. You will perhaps see that the whole system of this lecture is again applied, where I have tried to show you that what we call Old Testament and New Testament, antiquity and Christianity, church and state, world history, can be seen even in the working of two generations. That this is the analogy, but not one generation. The last century liberalism, you see, has tried to find the life of Christ in one man's life. This atomization, the life of Jesus, you see, is just, could we live by everybody, is wrong. I have tried to show you that between two generations, the secret of real living can be found, perhaps, but not inside one life. And I have drawn your attention in Melville's case to the fact that, after all, he covers two generations. That's not a one-generation, you see. That's in himself a double problem. And he pays with by one generation of his existence for the glory of the other. So, the primary atom of history, gentlemen, are two generations, not one generation. I think that is a tremendous item to be learned again in Melville's own existence. We did it with William James and Henry James. Now I do it inside one man's existence, you see. This is the first unit, the first digit, so to speak, you see, in counting time in real history. And this is very difficult for you again, but it does away with all the Enlightenment. What we called Nietzsche, gentlemen, was timeless life. That is just one generation, the matter of one age. And this frame of reference of Benjamin Franklin or of Cooper, that it all matters, you see, what one generation thinks or does, this must be repudiated. This isn't true. Because all the sufferings of Melville are only meaningful if you accept the fact that he paid by one generation for the other, waited for further generations to come to do justice to his ending as the first man in America, the dream of naturalness. Something else. In his Pierre, he undertakes to show that a man who is really self still needs the other sex. In the Sister, the man who does not want to live beyond his own generation, he doesn't want to be son or father, who breaks away with the whole ancestry and doesn't want to have children, will still have to be supplemented by one other human being of the opposite sex. It's a very profound thing in this Pierre that the possible fiancé from whom he could have children and his real mother and father, who project his life into the past, you see, are replaced by this sister out of wedlock, which is pure nature, that is simply the contemporary person, you see, in his own selfhood, selfishness. Now, gentlemen, this is, I think, the greatness we have to ascribe to Mr. Freud and the whole problem of today, of psychoanalysis, that men, even if he escapes into space, into self, out of time, when he is unable to procreate or to feel procreated, that he still needs one other person to fulfill himself. That is, the natural men of psychoanalysis are still two. Very different from Rousseau again and Franklin and the self-made men, you see. And the individualism of the 19th and 18th century, where the people say A equals A. Well, it isn't true here in Melville's case. So, what do we say? This A times B, this brother-sister proposition, B as the self, you see, that has to be sacrificed, as it is there. They both perish, so to speak, into nothingness, into just their own moment of fulfillment. This, then, is already outside the vision of Rousseau and of Thoreau and of the self-contained, self-autonomous, you see, reasonable being. Because man is haunted by sex and he isn't self, you see, with reason doesn't do anything to his real existence. So reason is replaced by sex. And I think we should subscribe to this. And again, this is only meaningful in 1950, gentlemen. The nature which Melville replaces the secular nature in the place of reason in 1750 is, so to speak, valid today, because we would say today what we find as natural in men is his sexuality, but not as reason, because reason had ulterior motives. You see, and depth psychology shows that you can reason out anything if you want to have something, and usually somebody of the other sex. That's just rationalization, as we say. So there is a second thing to be learned, gentlemen. He replaces the vision of self as a homo sapiens, of the rational being, by this definition, so to speak, in here, that the self still would have to break all laws of the universe to fulfill itself with the next of kin. Not to step into time. When self is considered a being in space, incest is the consequence. As it is in all modern literature, by the way. When you have no task in life to fulfill, not to free the slaves, not to go west, not to discover the universe, not to invent the airplane, that is, then man has no historical task to fulfill. You see, he's thrown back on his sexual nature much more than on his rational nature. All this I wanted to do, and to begin to see how miraculous people live. And this is the last point I wish to make before I stop here and leave the rest for the next meeting, is this. If you go beyond 1750, backward, in Melville's ancestry, you find Shakespeare and you find the Bible. You find the King James Version of 1611, and you find another 150 years shown in for good measure, so to speak, for his wavelength, for his vocabulary, for his eloquence. You know this very well as a reporter, don't you? I mean, and that he's just very knowingly read Shakespeare before he wrote Moby Dick, to fill himself up with the whole barrel, so to speak, of spirits. To get this eloquence. Yeah. Gentlemen, when any literary man, any man who really speaks, any orator, I too hear, gentlemen, when I want to convey truth, it isn't myself that speaks, but it's time, a great stream of time out of which my words emerge, and I only let them pass through my receptacle, my vessel of clay. You must learn again that a teacher doesn't teach as long as he speaks himself. That's nonsense. You have this idea. And if you are decent receptacles of the truth, gentlemen, you don't listen yourself. You listen with responsibility. That is, even if you don't do anything, you will still have to pass on the truth to somebody else. Whether it's your child or your friend, that is in a real emergency, you may say, I didn't heed the warning of the class in 1557, that you may need this, so I pass it on to you, try it. I mean, this strikes me as pertinent to your case. In every case, gentlemen, that we speak, we travel on some wavelength that is beyond our own generation. You too, in listening, and this is the most difficult thing for you to think, that I'm not talking to you at all. As mere selves. I cannot talk to a self because selves have ulterior motives. I do not talk to you for letting you pass an examination. I'm not interested in this. You may be interested in this, unfortunately. But that's a byproduct of the course. If I would think, how do I make this boy pass the course, you see, I certainly couldn't teach you anything. Therefore, I try to save the truth beyond you, through you. But you are just the hose through which the water must be, poured so that it reaches out into the future. Don't take yourself as never ask this question, what do I get out of this? This is impossible for you to solve. The truth is not there to be getting, so that you can get something out of it. The truth is much more important than you because it connects you and makes you out of selves into links of the whole edifice. Therefore, gentlemen, Melville has a second wavelength on which he travels with. In his eloquence, he covers three centuries. Here is the year 1600 that reaches America poignantly once more after the divines and their servants have exhausted themselves, after nobody has read the Bible, but if you read Moby Dick, you still read the Bible. because the perception is still there of a cosmic universe in which God has loved men so much that he sent his inborn son into the world. The cosmos, the whole creation, is immeasurable. This makes you perhaps understand why his importance begins only today. It took him a whole century to get a hearing, because he is reaching backward beyond Franklin and Cooper and whom else did we have? Well, I would say Emerson or Thoreau, but whom else did we treat? Well, even beyond Edwards with his division of the natural man and the religious man. He is still a man of 1500. That is, before this country is reached, so to speak. This, I think, is terribly important, that you begin to see that this is the reason why he couldn't be heard in his generation. Anybody who travels on a wavelength that is so long, of course, can only get a hearing by ears that are not given to the immediate only. Now, you will admit that in 1850 this country slammed into the Missouri Proviso, the Sociology of the South was written. The 50s have until the Know Nothing Party was founded, that is the early McCarthy's. In 1858 they tried to write the McCarran Law, even worse than today, you see, taking away full citizenship from the newcomers to this country. Everything in the 50s was exactly of the same class of hopeless, faceless, immediate selfishness, and without this, that's why the Republican Party had to be founded in 1854, you see, because it was such a low end in America. You can hardly imagine, if you read the Sociology of the South, where slavery is recommended as the natural institution, you see, as final, as the best thing to be. You must read this. The Sociology of the South is a very important book. In Europe, at the same time, there was written the book on the inequality of the human races by the Count de Gobineau. And it was the moment in which God really seemed to hold his breath. Because all the injustices were suddenly consecrated. Seemed just, you see, life seemed to lose all its direction. In France, the workers had been, as you know, crushed by Napoleon III, so the reaction was everywhere. In this moment, Melville tries to cry, you see. And there is no reaction. And in his fear, he, so to speak, predicts that selfish man that must come out of such a spiritless life. If every generation is only left to itself, this is the result. The whole endeavor I try to make you is to build carefully out of this two-generation unit, the larger units of history, gentlemen. Once you understand that the times do not consist of one moment and then more moments and more moments, but always consist of the dialogue inside every one of you between what you have received and what you have to hand on, then you see that this dualism of holding on to part of the past and creating something in the future is the two-generation principle. And it's worth looking at this, because it explains what we have to do today. It explains that, for example, the teacher-student relationship, the parent-son relationship, is at the heart of all our understanding of living, because it has been marooned, it has been abandoned. I mean, the parents just do not dare to tell the children anything. Today, we get a call, Mrs. Hissy wanted to go skiing, with a young mother who needs it badly. She's completely overworked. She has a 14-year-old daughter. The daughter has decided that she wants to stay at home. She doesn't feel well. She went out too many evenings. It's a very simple thing. So the mother says she would feel lonely if I went skiing. So since this girl doesn't go to school, she must stay with this girl. This is this kind of parent slavery which you have to do. It's utterly ridiculous, you see. Why? If the girl would go to school, she would allow herself to go skiing, but because this child is just has to sleep out, so to speak, because she had too much pleasure the last 4 years, the mother must even have no pleasure on the fifth day. The logic is you see, too exalted. Where they found a wonderful way out, the younger boy of 10 decided then not to go to school either. Then the mother said, now I can go skiing because they both can play together. But it is this idea that for the first 20 years of life you have only to have pleasure and willfulness, you see, and after this you have nothing. Absolutely nothing. This is we have heaven first and hell later today.
You will see that. Then you have to wash the dishes.
So, come forward with your Brian.
I don't know if I'll have time to read it, so I might run a few minutes over.